Starless Night, Chapter 11, Futility.
"This the place?"
the Battle Rager asked, shouting so that his gruff voice could be heard over the whipping wind. He had come out of Mithril Hall with Regis and Brunner, had forced the halfling to take him out, actually, in search of the body of Artemis and Treri.
"You find the clues where you find them,"
Point had said in typically cryptic explanation. Regis pulled the cowl of his oversized cloak low to ward off the wind's sting. They were in a narrow valley, a gully, the sides of which seemed to focus the considerable wind into a torrent.
"It was around here,"
Regis said, shrugging his shoulders to indicate that he could not be sure. When he'd come out to find the battered and Treri, he had taken a higher route along the top of the ravine and other ledges. He was certain that he was in the general region, but things looked too different from the perspective to be sure.
"We'll find him, me king,"
Thibodorf assured Brunner.
"For what that's worth,"
the dejected Brunner grumbled. Regis winced at the dwarf's deflated tones. He recognized clearly that Brunner was slipping back into despair. The dwarves had found no way through the maze of tunnels beneath Mithril Hall, though 1,000 were searching, and word from the east was not promising. If Caterbury and Drizzt had gone to Silvery Moon, they were long past that place now. Brunner was coming to realize the futility of it all. 10 days had passed, and he had not found a way out of Mithril Hall that would take him anywhere near his friends. The dwarf was losing hope.
"But me king,"
Point roared.
"He knows the way."
"He's dead," Brunner reminded the Battle Rager.
"Not to worry,"
bellowed Point.
"Priests can talk to the dead, and he might have a map. Oh, we'll find our way to this drow city, I tell you. And there I'll go for me king. I'll kill every stinking drow, except that ranger fellow,"
he added, throwing a wink at Regis.
"And bring your girl back home."
Brunner just sighed and motioned for Point to get on with the hunt. Despite all the complaining, though, the Dwarf King privately hoped that he might find some satisfaction in seeing Entreri's broken body. They moved on for a short while, Regis constantly peeking out from his cowl, trying to get his bearings. Finally, the halfling spotted a high outcropping, a branch-like jag of rock.
"There,"
he said, pointing the way.
"That must be it."
Point looked up, then followed a direct line to the ravine's bottom. He began scrambling around on all fours, sniffing the ground as if trying to pick up the corpse's scent. Regis watched him, amused, then turned to Brunner, who stood against the gully's wall, his hand on the stone, shaking his head.
"What is it?"
Regis asked, walking over. Hearing the question and noticing his king, Point scampered to join them. When he got close, Regis noticed something along the stone wall, something gray and matted. He peered closer as Brunner pulled a bit of the substance from the stone and held it out.
"What is it?"
Regis asked again, daring to touch it. A stringy filament came away from the retracting finger, and it took some effort to shake the gooey stuff free. Brunner had to swallow hard several times. Point ran off, sniffing at the wall, then across the ravine to consider the stone on the other side.
"It's what's left of a web,"
the Dwarf King answered grimly. Both Brunner and Regis looked up to the jutting rock and silently considered the implications of a web strung below the falling assassin. Fingers flashed too quickly for him to follow, conveying some instructions that the assassin did not understand. He shook his head furiously, and the flustered drow clapped his ebonskin hands together, uttered, "Iblith," and walked away. "Iblith," Artemis and Treri echoed silently in his thoughts. The drow word for awful. It was a word he had heard the most since Jarlaxle had taken him to this wretched place. What could that drow soldier have expected from him? He was only beginning to learn the intricate drow hand code, its finger movements so precise and detailed that Andreri doubted that 1 in 20 humans could even begin to manage it. And he was trying desperately to learn the drow spoken language as well. He knew a few words and had a basic understanding of drow sentence structure, so he could put simple ideas together. And he knew the word Iblith all too well. The assassin leaned back against the wall of the small cave, this 10 days base of operations for Bregan D'Arth. He felt smaller, more insignificant than ever. When Jarlaxle had first revived him, in a cave in the ravine outside of Mithril Hall, he had thought the mercenary's offer, actually more of a command, and Trevi realized, to take him to Menzoberranzan a wonderful thing, a grand adventure. This was no adventure. This was living hell. In Trevi was Kolnbluth, non-drow, living in the midst of 20,000 of the less-than-tolerant race. They didn't particularly hate humans, no more than they hated anybody else, but because he was Kolnbluth, the once-powerful assassin found himself beneath the lowest ranks of Brake and D'Arthur's drow force. No matter what he did, no matter who he killed, in Menzoberranzan, Artemis and Trevi could never rank higher than 20,000 and first. And the spiders. And Trevi hated spiders. And the crawly things were everywhere in the drow city. They were bred into larger, more poisonous varieties, and were kept as pets. And to kill a spider was a crime carrying the punishment of Jivrin Quielgin, torture until death. In the great cavern's eastern end, the moss bed and mushroom grove near the Lake of Donnygarden, where Entreri was often put to work herding goblin slaves, spiders crawled about by the thousands. They crawled around him, crawled on him, hung down in strands dangling inches from the tormented man's face. The assassin drew his green gleaming sword and held its wicked edge before his eyes. At least there was more light in the city now. For some reason that Entreri did not know, magical lights and flickering torches had become much more common in Menzoberranzan. It would not be wise to stain so marvelous a weapon with drow blood, came a familiar voice from the doorway, easily speaking the common tongue. Entreri didn't take his gaze from the blade as Jarlaxle entered the small room.
You presume that I would find the strength to harm one of the mighty drow, the assassin replied. How could I? The Iblith? He started to ask, but Jarlaxle's laughter mocked his self-pity. Entreri glanced over at the mercenary and saw the drow holding his wide-brimmed hat in his hand, fiddling with the diatryma feather. I have never underestimated your prowess, assassin, Jarlaxle said. You have survived several fights against Driz Duarden, and few in Menzoberranzan will ever make that claim. I was fighting equal, Entreri said through gritted teeth. Simply uttering the words stung him. He had battled Drizzt several times, but only twice they had fought without a premature interruption. On both those occasions, Entreri had lost. Entreri wanted desperately to even the score, to prove himself the better fighter. Still, he had to admit to himself, at least, that in his heart he did not desire another fight with Drizzt. After the first time he lost Drizzt in the muddy sewers and streets of Kalimport, Entreri had lived every day plotting revenge, had shaped his life around one event, his rematch with Drizzt. But after his second loss, the one in which he had wound up hanging, broken and miserable, from a jag of rock in a windswept ravine... But what? Entreri wondered. Why did he no longer wish to battle the renegade drow? Had the point been proven, the decision rendered? Or was he simply too afraid? The emotions were unsettling to Artemis Entreri, as out of place within him as he was in the drow city.
I was his fighting equal, he whispered again,
with as much conviction as he could muster.
I would not state that openly, if I were you, the mercenary replied. Dantrag Benre and Uthan Gentle Armgo would fight one another simply to determine which of them got to kill you first.
Entreri did not blink. His sword flared, as if reflecting his simmering pride and anger. Jarlaxle laughed again.
To determine which would get to fight you first, the mercenary corrected,
and he swept a low and apologetic bow. Still, the out-of-place assassin didn't blink. Might he regain a measure of pride by killing one of these legendary drow warriors, he wondered. Or would he lose again, and, worse than being killed, be forced to live with that fact? Entreri snapped the sword down and slipped it into his scabbard. He had never been so hesitant, so unsure. Even as a young boy, surviving on the brutal streets of Kalimshan's crowded cities, Entreri had brimmed with confidence and had used that confidence to advantage. But not here, not in this place.
Your soldiers taunt me,"
he snapped suddenly, transferring his frustration the mercenary's way. Jarlaxle laughed and put his hat back on his bald head.
"Kill a few,"
he offered, and Entrevi couldn't tell if the cold, calculating drow was kidding or not.
"The rest will then leave you alone."
Entrevi spat on the floor. Leave him alone. The rest would wait until he was asleep, then cut him into little pieces to feed to the spiders of Donegarden. That thought broke the assassin's narrow-eyed concentration, forced him to wince. He had killed a female, which, in Menzoberranzan, was much worse than killing a male, and some houses in the city might be starving their spiders right now in anticipation of a human feast.
"Ah, but you are so crude," the mercenary said, as though he pitied the man.
Entrevi sighed and looked away, bringing a hand up to rub his saliva-wetted lips. What was he becoming? In Kalimport, in the guilds, even among the pashas and those others that called themselves his masters, he had been in control. He was a killer hired by the most treacherous, double-dealing thieves in all the realms, and yet not one had ever tried to cross Artemis Entrevi. How he longed to see the pale sky of Kalimport again.
"Fear not, my Abil,"
Jarlaxle said, using the drow word for trusted friend.
"You will again see the sunrise."
The mercenary smiled widely at Entreri's expression, apparently understanding that he had just read the assassin's very thoughts.
"You and I will watch the dawn from the doorstep of Mithril Hall."
They were going back after Drizzt, Entrevi realized. This time, judging from the lights in Menzoberranzan, which he now came to understand, Clan Battlehammer itself would be crushed.
"That is,"
Jarlaxle continued teasingly, "unless House Horlbar takes the time to discover that it was you who slew one of its matron mothers." With a click of his boot and a tip of his hat, Jarlaxle spun out of the room. Jarlaxle knew, and the female had been a matron mother. Feeling perfectly miserable, Entrevi leaned heavily against the wall. How was he to know that the wicked beast in the alley was a damned matron mother? The walls seemed to close in on the man, suffocating him. Cold sweat beaded on the normally cool brow, and he labored to draw breath. All his thoughts centered on possible escape, but they inevitably slammed against the unyielding stone walls. He was caught by logistics as much by drow blades. He had tried to escape once, had run out of Menzoberranzan and through the eastern exit beyond Donegarden. But where could he go? The Underdark was a maze of dangerous tunnels and deep holes filled with monsters the assassin did not know how to fight. Entrevi was a creature of the very different surface world. He did not understand the wild Underdark, could not hope to survive there for long. Certainly, he would never find his own way back to the surface. He was trapped, caged, stripped of his pride and his dignity, and, sooner or later, he was going to be horribly killed.
Bonus Chapter.
Chapter 12. Rising to the Occasion.
"We can drop this whole section,"
General Dagna remarked as he poked a stubby finger against the map spread on the table.
"Drop it,"
bellowed the Battle Rager.
"If you drop it, then how are we going to kill the stinking drow?"
Regis, who had arranged this meeting, looked incredulously to Dagna and the other three dwarven commanders huddled around the table. Then he looked back to Puent.
"The ceiling will kill the stinking drow," he explained.
"Bah! Sandstone!"
huffed the Battle Rager.
"What fun do you call that? I got to grease up me armor with some drow blood, I do. But with your stupid plan, I'll have to do a month's digging just to find a body to rub against." "Lead the charge down here,"
Dagna offered, pointing to another section of open corridors on the map.
"The rest of us will give you a 100-foot head start."
Regis put a sour look on the general and moved it in turn to each of the other dwarves, who were all bobbing their heads in agreement. Dagna was only half-kidding, Regis knew. More than a few of Clan Battlehammer would not be teary-eyed if obnoxious Thibbledorf Puent happened to be among the fallen in the potential fight against the Dark Elves.
Drop the tunnel, Regis said to get them back on track. We'll need strong defenses here and here, he added, pointing to the two open areas in the otherwise tight lower tunnels. I'm meeting later this day with Berthagar of Settlestone.
You bringing the smelly humans in?
Puent asked. Even the dwarves, who favored the strong smells of soot-covered, sweaty bodies, twisted their faces at the remark. In Mithril Hall, it was said that Puent's armpit could curl a hardy flower at 50 yards.
I don't know what I'm doing with the humans, Regis answered. I haven't even told them my suspicions of a drow raid yet. If they agree to join our cause, and I have no reason to believe that they won't, I suspect that we would be wise to keep them out of the lower tunnels, even though we plan to light those tunnels.
Dagna nodded his agreement.
A wise choice indeed, he said. The tall men are better suited to fighting along the mountainsides. My own guess is that the drow will come in around the mountain as well as through it.
The men of Settlestone will meet them, added another dwarf.
From the shadows of the partially closed door at the side of the room, Brunner Battlehammer looked on curiously. He was amazed at how quickly Regis had taken things into his control, especially given the fact that the halfling did not wear his hypnotic ruby pendant. After scolding Brunner for not acting quickly and decisively, for falling back into a mire of self-pity when the trails of Caterbury and Drizzt apparently closed, the halfling, with Puent in tow, had gone straight to General Dagna and the other war commanders. What amazed Brunner now was not the fact that the dwarves had gone eagerly into preparations for war, but the fact that Regis seemed to be leading them. Of course, the halfling had concocted a lie to assume that role. Using Brunner's resumed indifference, the halfling was faking meetings with the dwarf king, then going to Dagna and the others, pretending that he was bringing word straight from Brunner. When he first discovered the ruse, Brunner wanted to throttle the halfling, but Regis had stood up to him and had offered, more than sincerely, to step aside if Brunner wanted to take over. Brunner wished that he could, desperately wanted to find the level of energy once more, but any thought of warfare inevitably led him to memories of his recent past battles, most of them beside Drizzt, Caterbury, and Wulfgar. Paralyzed by those painful memories, Brunner had simply dismissed Regis and allowed the halfling to go on with his facade. Dagna was as fine a strategist as any, but his experience was rather limited regarding races other than dwarves or stupid goblins. Regis was among Drizzt's best friends, had sat and listened to Drizzt's tales of his homeland and his kin hundreds of times. Regis had also been among Wulfgar's best friends, and so he understood the barbarians, whom the dwarves would need as allies should the war come to pass. Still, Dagna had never been fond of anyone who wasn't a dwarf, and the fact that he wholeheartedly accepted the advice of a halfling, and one not known for bravery, surprised Brunner more than a little. It stung the king as well. Brunner knew of the Dark Elves and the barbarians at least as well as Regis, and he understood dwarven tactics better than anyone. He should be at the table, pointing out the sections of the map. He should be the one, with Regis beside him, to meet with Berthagar the Bold. Brunner dropped his gaze to the floor, rubbed a hand over his brow and down his grotesque scar. He felt an ache in the hollow socket. Hollow, too, was his heart, empty with the loss of Wulfgar and breaking apart at the thought that Drizzt and his precious Caterbury had gone off into danger. The events about him had gone beyond his responsibilities as king of Mithril Hall. Brunner's first dedication was to his children, one lost, the other missing, and to his friends. Their fates were beyond him now. He could only hope that they would win out, would survive and come back to him, for Brunner had no way to get to Caterbury and Drizzt. Brunner could never get back to Wulfgar. The dwarf king sighed and turned away, walking slowly back toward his empty room, not even noticing that the meeting had adjourned. Regis watched Brunner silently from the doorway, wishing that he had his ruby pendant, if for no other reason than to try to rekindle the fires in the broken dwarf. Caterbury eyed the wide corridor ahead suspiciously, trying to make out distinct shapes among the many stalagmite mounds. She had come into a region where mud mixed with stone, and she had seen the tracks clearly enough, goblin tracks, she knew, and recent. Ahead loomed the perfect place for an ambush. Caterbury took an arrow from the quiver strapped behind her hip. then held Talmoril the Heartseeker, her magical bow, ready in her hands. Tucked under one arm, ready to be dropped, was the panther figurine. She silently debated whether or not she should summon Gwenhyber from the astral plane. She had no real proof that the goblins were about. All the mounds in the corridor seemed natural and benign, but she felt the hairs on the back of her neck tingle. She decided to hold off calling the cat, her logic overruling her instincts. She fell against the left-hand wall and slowly started forward, wincing every time the mud sloshed around her lifting boot. With a dozen stalagmite mounds behind her, the wall still tightly to her left, the young woman paused and listened once more. All seemed perfectly quiet, but she couldn't shake the feeling that her every step was being monitored, that some monster was poised not far away, waiting to spring out and throttle her. Would it be like this all the way through the Underdark? She wondered. Would she drive herself insane with imagined dangers? Or worse, would the false alarms of her misguided instincts take her off guard on that one occasion when danger really did rise against her? Catterby shook her head to clear the thoughts and squinted her eyes to peer into the magically starlit gloom. Another benefit of Lady Illustrial's gift was that Catterby's eyes did not glow with the telltale red of infravision. The young woman, though, inexperienced in such matters, didn't know that. She knew only that the shapes ahead seemed ominous indeed. The ground and walls were not firmly set, as in other parts of the tunnels. Mud and open water flowed freely in different areas. Many of the stalagmites seemed to have appendages, goblin arms, perhaps, holding wicked weapons. Again, Catterby forced away the unwanted thoughts, and she started forward, but froze immediately. She had caught a sound, a slight scraping, like that of a weapon tip brushing against stone. She waited a long while, but heard nothing more. So she again told herself not to let her imagination carry her away. But had those goblin tracks been part of her imagination? She asked herself as she took another step forward. Catterby dropped the figurine and swung about, her bow coming to bear. Around the nearest stalagmite charged a goblin, its ugly flat face seeming broader from the wide grin it wore, and its rusting and jagged sword held high above its head. Catterby fired point-blank, and the silver streaking arrow had barely cleared the bow when the monster's head exploded in a shower of multicolored sparks. The arrow blasted right through, sparking again as it sliced a chunk off the stalagmite mound. "Gwenhyber!" Catterby called, and she readied the bow. She knew she had to get moving, that this area had been clearly marked by the spark shower. She considered the gray mist that had begun to swirl around her, and, knowing the summoning was complete, scooped up the figurine and ran away from the wall. She hopped the dead goblin's body and cut around the nearest stalagmite, then slipped between two others. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw another 4-foot-tall huddled shape. An arrow streaked off in pursuit, its silvery tail stealing the darkness, and scored another hit. Catterby did not smile, though, for the flash of light revealed a dozen more of the ugly humanoids slinking and crawling about the mounds. They screamed and hooted and began their charge. Over by the wall, gray mist gave way to the powerful panther's tangible form. Gwenhyber recognized the urgency of the call and was on alert immediately, ears flattened and shiny green eyes peering about, taking full measure of the scene. Quieter than the night, the cat lopped off. Catterby circled farther out from the wall, taking a roundabout course to flank the approaching group. Every time she came past another blocking mound, she let an arrow fly, as often hitting stone as goblins. She knew that confusion was her ally here, and that she had to keep the creatures from organizing, or they would surround her. Another arrow streaked away, and in its illumination, Catterby saw a closer target. A goblin crouched right behind the mound she would soon pass. She went behind the mound, skidded to a stop, and came back out the same way, desperately working to fit an arrow. The goblin swung around the mound and rushed in, sword leading. Catterby battered with her bow, barely knocking the weapon aside. She heard a sucking sound behind her, then a hiss, and instinctively dropped to her knees. A goblin pitched over her suddenly low form and crashed into the surprised ally. The two were up quickly, though, as quickly as Catterby. The woman worked her bow out in front to keep them at bay, tried to get her free hand down to grab a jeweled dagger on her belt. Sensing their advantage, the goblins charged, then went tumbling away along with 600 pounds of flying panther. "Gwen!" Catterby mouthed in silent appreciation, and she pivoted about, pulling an arrow from her quiver. As she expected, goblins were fast closing from behind. Tolmeril twanged once again, and then a third time, Catterby blasting holes in the ranks. She used the sudden and deadly explosions of streaking lines and sparks as cover and ran, not away, as she knew the goblins would expect, but straight ahead, backtracking along her original route. She had them fooled as she ducked behind another mound, wide and thick, and nearly giggled when a goblin leaped out behind her, rubbing its light-stung eyes and looking back the other way. Just 5 feet behind the stupid thing, Catterby let fly the arrow blasting into the goblin's back, snaring on a bone and sending the creature flying through the air. Catterby spun and ran on, around the back side of the wide mound. She heard a roar from Gwenhiver, followed by the profound screams of another group of goblins. Ahead, a huddled form was running away from her, and she lifted her bow, ready to clear the path. Something jolted her on the hip. She released the bowstring, and the arrow zipped wide of the mark, scorching a hole in the wall. Catterby stumbled off balance, startled and hurt. She banged her shin against a jutting stone and nearly pitched headlong, skidding to a stop, down on one knee. As she reached down to get another arrow from her quiver, she felt the wet warmth of her own lifeblood pouring generously from a deep gash in her hip. Only then did stunned Catterby realize the hot waves of agony. She kept her wits about her and turned as she fitted the arrow. The goblin was right above her, its breath coming hot and smelly through pointed yellow teeth. Its sword was high above his head. Catterby let fly. The goblin jerked up into the air, but came back to his feet. Behind it, another goblin caught the arrow under the chin, the powerful bolt blowing the back of its skull off. Catterby thought she was dead. How could she have missed? Did the arrow slip under the goblin's arm as it jumped in fright? It made no sense to her, but she could hardly stop to think it over. The moment of death was upon her, she was sure, for she could not maneuver her bow quickly enough to parry the goblin's next strike. She could not block the descending sword. But the sword did not descend. The goblin simply stopped, held perfectly still for what seemed to Catterby an interminable time. Its sword then clanged to the stone. A wheeze issued from the center of its ribcage, followed by a thick line of blood. The monster toppled to the side, dead. Catterby realized then that the arrow had indeed hit the mark, had driven cleanly through the first goblin to kill the second. Catterby forced herself to her feet. She tried to run on, but waves rolled over her, and before she understood what had happened, she was back to the floor, back to one knee. She felt a coldness up her side, a swirling nausea in her stomach, and to her horror saw yet another of the miserable goblins fast closing, waving a spiked club. Summoning all of her strength, Catterby waited until the very last moment and whipped her bow across in front of her. The goblin shrieked and fell backward, avoiding the hit, but its sudden retreat gave Catterby the time to draw her short sword and the jeweled dagger. She stood, forcing down the pain and sick feeling. The goblin uttered something in its annoying, high-pitched voice, something threatening, Catterby knew, though it sounded like a typical goblin whine. The wretched creature came at her all of a sudden, whipping the club to and fro, and Catterby leaped back. A jolting flare of agony rushed up her side, nearly costing her her balance. On came the goblin, crouched and balanced, sensing victory. It continued to talk to her, taunt her, though she could not understand its language. It chuckled and pointed to her wounded leg. Catterby was confident that she could defeat the goblin, but she feared that it would be to no avail. Even if she and Gwenhiver won out, killed all the goblins or sent them fleeing, what might come next? Her leg would barely support her. Certainly she could not continue her quest, and she doubted that she could properly clean and dress the wound. The goblins might not kill her, but they had stopped her, and the waves of pain continued unabated. Catterby's eyes rolled back, and she started to sway. Her eyes blinked open, and she steadied herself as the goblin took the bait and charged. When it realized the ruse, it tried to stop, but skidded in the slippery mud. The goblin whipped its club across frantically, but Catterby's short sword intercepted it, locking against one of the spikes. Knowing that she had not the strength to force the club aside, she pressed forward into the goblin, tucking her sword arm in close as she went, forcing the goblin's arm to hook about her as she turned. All the while, the jeweled dagger led the way, reaching for the creature's belly. The goblin got its free arm up to block, and only the dagger's tip slipped through its skin. Catterby did not know how long she could hold the clinch. Her strength was draining. She wanted nothing more than to curl up in a little ball and faint away. Then, to her surprise, the goblin cried out in agony. It whipped its head back and forth, shook its whole body wildly in an effort to get away. Catterby, barely holding the dangerous club at bay, had to keep pace with it. A burst of energy pulsed through the dagger and coursed up her arm. The young woman didn't know what to make of it, didn't know what was happening as the goblin went into a series of violent convulsions, each one sending another pulse of energy flowing into its foe. The creature fell back against the stone, its blocking arm limp, and Catterby's momentum carried her closer, the wicked dagger sinking into the hilt. The next pulse of energy nearly knocked Catterby away, and her eyes widened in horror as she realized that Artemis Cendreri's weapon was literally eating away at the goblin's life force and transferring it to her. The goblin sprawled over the arching edge of the stalagmite mound, its eyes open and unblinking, its body twitching in death spasms. Catterby fell back, taking the bloody dagger with her. She worked hard to draw breath, gasping in disbelief and eyeing the blade with sheer revulsion. A roar from Gwenhiver reminded her that the battle was not ended. She replaced the dagger on her belt and turned, thinking that she had to find her bow. She'd gone two running steps before she even realized that her leg was easily supporting her now. From somewhere in the shadows, a goblin heaved a spear which skipped off the stone just behind the running woman and stole her train of thought. Catterby skidded down in the mud and scooped up her bow as she slid past. She looked down to her quiver, saw its powerful magic already at work replacing the spent arrows. She saw, too, that no more blood was coming from her wound. Gingerly, the young woman ran her hand over it, felt a thick scab already in place. She shook her head in disbelief, took up her bow, and began firing. Only one more goblin got close to Catterby. It sneaked around the back side of the thick mound. The young woman started to drop her bow and draw at her weapon for melee, but she stopped. And so did the goblin, when a great panther's paw slapped down atop the creature's head and long claws dug into the goblin's sloping forehead. Gwenhiver snapped the creature backward with sudden, savage force, such that one of the monster's shoddy boots remained where it had been standing. Catterby looked away, back to the area behind them, as Gwenhiver's powerful maw closed over the stunned goblin's throat and began to squeeze. Catterby saw no targets, but let fly another arrow to brighten the end of the corridor. Half a dozen goblins were in full flight, and Catterby sent a shower of arrows trailing them, chasing them, and cutting them down. She was still firing a minute later. Her enchanted quiver would never run out of arrows, when Gwenhiver padded over to her and bumped her, demanding a pat. Catterby sighed deeply and dropped a hand to the cat's muscled flank, her eyes falling to the jeweled dagger sitting impassively on her belt. She had seen Entreri wield that dagger, had once had its blade against her own throat. The young woman shuddered as she recalled that awful moment, more awful now that she understood the cruel weapon's properties. Gwenhiver growled and pushed up against her, prodding her to motion. Catterby understood the panther's urgency. According to Drizzt's tales, goblins rarely traveled in the Underdark in secluded bands. If there were 20 here, there were likely 200 somewhere nearby. Catterby looked to the tunnel behind them, the tunnel from which she had come and down which the goblins had fled. She considered briefly going that way, fighting through the fleeing few and running back to the surface world, where she belonged. It was a fleeting thought for her, an excusable instant of weakness. She knew that she must go on. But how? Catterby looked down to her belt once more and smiled as she untied the magical mask. She lifted it before her face, unsure of how it even worked. With a shrug to Gwenhiver, the young woman pressed the mask against her face. Nothing happened. Holding it tight, she thought of Drizzt, imagined herself with ebony skin and a fine, chiseled features of a drow. Biting tingles of magic nipped at her every pore. In a moment, she moved her hand away from her face, the mask holding fast of its own accord. Catterby blinked many times, for in the magical starlight afforded her by the cat's eye, she saw her receding hand shining perfectly black, her fingers more slender and delicate than she remembered them. How easy it had been. Catterby wished that she had a mirror so that she could check the disguise, though she felt in her heart that it was true. She considered how perfectly Entreri had mimicked Regis when he had come back to Mithril Hall, right down to the halfling's equipment. With that thought, the young woman looked to her own rather drab garb. She considered Drizzt's tales of his homeland, the fabulous and evil high priestesses of Loth. Catterby's worn traveling cloak had become a rich robe, shimmering purple and black. Her boots had blackened, their tips curling up delicately. Her weapons remained the same, though, and it seemed to Catterby, in this attire, that Entreri's jeweled dagger was the most fitting. Again, the young woman focused her thoughts on that wicked blade. A part of her wanted to drop it in the mud, to bury it where no one could ever find it. She even went so far as to close her fingers over its hilt. But she released the dagger immediately, strengthened her resolve, and smoothed her drow-like robes. The blade had helped her. Without it, she would be crippled and lost, if not dead. It was a weapon, like her bow, and though its brutal tactics assaulted her sensibilities, Catterby came, in that moment, to accept them. She carried the dagger more easily as the days turned into a 10-day, and then 2. This was the Underdark, where the savage survived.